What if I told you that the single greatest crisis of the 20th century, a global conflagration that claimed millions of lives, was also the setting for history's most vast, unspoken, and brutally efficient mating market, one whose rules were written not by generals, but by the silent, desperate choices of women? And that within the next minutes, you will see how declassified documents and personal letters from World War II expose a biological imperative so powerful, so ruthless in its execution, that it rewrites everything you thought you knew about love, loyalty, and the true nature of female desire. The year is 1942. The world is on fire. For millions of young American, British, and Canadian men, life has been violently distilled into a simple, terrifying binary: the fight for survival and the dream of home. They crouch in frozen foxholes in the Ardennes, their breath misting in the air, fingers numb on rifle bolts. They scan endless, empty skies over the Pacific, their ears straining for the drone of engines that could mean death. Their world is one of mud, metal, and a pervasive, grinding fear. But in their minds, they carry a talisman, a psychological anchor against the storm. They carry the memory of her, the girl back home, her face in a photograph tucked next to their heart, the scent of her perfume on a letter, a fragile ghost of a world that now seems impossibly distant. She is his reason. She is what he is fighting for. He imagines her working a rivet gun in a factory, her hair tied back, doing her part. He imagines her writing him letters, faithful, waiting, her love a constant star in his blacked-out world. This narrative of the faithful sweetheart holding the home front is the bedrock of the war's romantic mythology. It is a story we tell ourselves to make the sacrifice noble, to give the horror a meaning softer than steel and blood. But history, when examined without sentimentality, tells a different story, a darker story. It reveals that for a staggering number of women, the greatest romantic opportunity of their lives arrived not in the peacetime tranquility of a dance hall, but on the roaring, apocalyptic wave of total war. To understand the phenomenon, we must first define our term not with modern political baggage, but with clinical, biological precision, hypergamy. From the Greek hyper, over, and gamos, marriage. It is the instinctual drive to form a pair bond with a partner of equal or, critically, higher status. This is not a moral failing. It is not a social construct. It is an evolutionary imperative, hardwired over millennia to ensure the survival and upward mobility of offspring. In a stable, structured society, this drive operates within certain constraints: social class, geographic proximity, familial expectations. It is a slow, simmering current. But place that same imperative into the crucible of a global crisis, an environment where all normal social structures have been vaporized, where death is a daily visitor, and where a massive, concentrated population of high-status males suddenly appears, and that slow current becomes a tidal wave. World War II didn't create female hypergamy. It simply removed all the cages, gave it a jetpack, and handed it a map. The home front was not a place of patient waiting. For many, it was a frantic, desperate, and ultimately opportunistic marketplace. Consider the environment. With the mass mobilization of men, women were thrust into the workforce en masse. They earned their own money, gained unprecedented independence, and experienced a social liberation that would have been unthinkable a decade prior. But this newfound freedom existed in a vacuum of male attention. The local dating pool, the boys from the farm, the clerks from the bank, the mechanics from the garage was gone, shipped out, replaced by a palpable, aching absence. This created a profound anxiety, a fear of being left behind, of missing one's chance in the prime reproductive years. Now layer on to this anxiety the arrival of a new kind of man. Not the local boys they had grown up with, but strangers, soldiers, airmen, commandos. These men were not defined by their pre-war social standing. The war had erased that. They were defined by their uniforms, by their perceived heroism, by the raw, lethal competence they represented. A sergeant from Texas, who might have been a farmhand in 1941, now possessed a glamour, a status, and a tangible power that dwarfed any local boy who stayed behind. He was a provider of nylons, of chocolate, of scarce luxury goods. But more than that, he was a provider of survival in a psychological sense. Aligning with him was a bet on the future, on the winning side. He represented a ticket out of a small town, a chance for a life more exciting and secure than the one she knew. This was the perfect hypergamic storm. The data is cold, brutal, and irrefutable. Let's move beyond theory and into the archives. The proof is in the paper trail. Historian Dawn Campbell, in her seminal work, Women at War with America, dissected the staggering statistics. In the United States, marriage rates skyrocketed during the war, far exceeding pre-war projections. But this wasn't a uniform phenomenon. The rate of marriage between women and men leaving for service exploded. It was a panic-induced rush to secure a bond before the uncertainty of departure. But the most telling data comes from what happened after the war, with the so-called war brides. The U.S. government passed the War Brides Act of 1945 and later the Foreign Fiancés Act to facilitate the immigration of the spouses and fiancés of American servicemen. The numbers are staggering. Over 100,000 women from the United Kingdom alone emigrated as war brides to be with their American husbands. Tens of thousands more came from Australia, New Zealand, and across liberated Europe, Italy, France, Germany. This was not a trickle. It was a mass migration of women, a literal voting with their feet on a global scale, choosing the American victor over their own countrymen. The British government, alarmed by the sheer exodus of its young women, conducted internal studies, fretting over the loss of its female population to the wealthy, glamorous Americans. Their own documents reveal a deep anxiety about the economic and social power imbalance. The GIs were perceived as better providers, their nation untouched by the ravages of war, offering a land of plenty compared to ration book Britain. This was hypergamy on a civilizational scale. Now let's descend from the macro level to the micro. Let's meet the people behind the numbers, and here is where the story becomes heartbreakingly human and where the dark reality comes into sharp, painful focus. The National Archives are filled with heart-wrenching letters from soldiers who returned home to find their world obliterated, not by bombs, but by betrayal. These are not dry historical documents. They are screams of anguish trapped in ink, frozen in time. Consider the case of Private James Miller from Ohio. His letters to his high school sweetheart, Mary, are a chronicle of devotion. He sends his pay home to her. He talks about the little house they will build. He draws pictures of the port swing in the margins. He survives the hell of the Battle of the Bulge, his body whole, but his mind scarred. He carries her photograph, cracked and faded, through it all. He is discharged in 1945, a hero in the eyes of the nation. He takes the long train ride home, his heart pounding with a hope that has kept him alive for 3 years. He arrives at her doorstep, flowers in hand. She opens the door. She is not alone. There is a man in an Army Air Corps officer's uniform standing behind her, his hand possessively on her shoulder. She looks at James, not with joy and embarrassment, but with pity and embarrassment. She introduces the man. He's a bomber pilot she met at a USO dance in Cleveland a year prior. They were married last month. James's entire world, the mental construct that allowed him to endure unspeakable horror, evaporates in that single moment. The government he fought for considers him a hero. The woman he fought for considers him a relic. His status as a lowly infantry private was eclipsed by the higher status of an officer, a pilot, a flyboy. His trauma, his sacrifice, meant nothing in the new hypergamic calculus. His story was repeated, with minor variations, hundreds of thousands of times.
Or take the even more jarring phenomenon of the Dear John letter. This wasn't just a breakup. It was a specific, brutal form of communication, a termination notice delivered to a man in a combat zone. Imagine the scene, a mail call at a forward base on some godforsaken Pacific island. Men crowd around, the one moment of joy in a week of terror. A lieutenant hands out the precious envelopes. One soldier, let's call him Corporal Evans, gets his letter. He recognizes the handwriting of his fiancée. He tears it open, a grin on his grimy face. He starts to read. The grin falters. The color drains from his face. The letter is not filled with love and longing. It is a cold, clinical document. It explains that she has met someone else, someone who is stateside, someone whose future is not in jeopardy. She is sorry, but she must be practical. She hopes he understands. She hopes he comes home safe. The paper falls from his fingers. The men around him fall silent. They know. They've seen it before. The military command recognized the devastating impact these letters had on morale and combat effectiveness. Some units even had officers who would pre-screen mail and withhold the Dear John letters until after a mission, fearing a despondent soldier would become a careless one, a danger to himself and his comrades. The war machine was literally being sabotaged by the unflinching operation of female hypergamy. The needs of the heart were overriding the needs of the nation. This behavior was rational. From a purely Darwinian perspective, it was brilliant. The woman who bonded with the highest status male available, the one with the best apparent chance of survival and provision, was making the optimal choice for her genetic legacy. The pilot, the officer, the technician with a safe posting, these were the prizes. The infantryman in the trenches, the sailor on a destroyer in submarine-infested waters, these were bad bets. Their mortality rates were terrifyingly high. To wait for them was to risk everything. The crisis acted as a filter, forcing women to make brutally efficient decisions. This is the core of the black pill truth. Sentimentality and past attachment are luxuries that cannot survive a genuine crisis. Loyalty is conditional. Love is contingent. It is contingent on a man's ability to maintain and project status and security, even, especially, when the world is falling apart. The soldier who left as a high school boyfriend returned to find the criteria had changed. He might have been a hero, but was he a provider? Did he have prospects? Or was he broken, traumatized, competing against men who had accrued status and wealth during the war, not just risked their lives? The battlefield did not end in Europe or the Pacific. It continued on the home front, a silent social battlefield where the weapons were charm, status, and the promise of security. And the casualties were the hearts of the men who had already given everything.
This is not an indictment of women. It is an indictment of a fairy tale narrative that has been sold to men for generations. The story of the faithful Penelope weaving her shroud while she waits decades for Odysseus to return from war is a myth. It is a story men tell themselves to make the inherent risk of commitment seem safe. World War II exposes this myth in the harshest possible light. It shows us the raw, unfiltered engine of human mating strategies. For the modern man, this is not a reason for despair. It is a reason for awakening. It is the ultimate red pill. Understanding that this drive exists, that it is primal and powerful, is the first step toward navigating it successfully. It means understanding that your value is not intrinsic. It is built, maintained, and demonstrated. It means knowing that in times of peace, the operation of hypergamy is slower, more subtle, but no less real. The man who believes love is unconditional is a man living on borrowed time. A man who will be blindsided when a personal crisis, a job loss, an illness, a depression, temporarily lowers his status and reveals the true nature of the bonds he thought were unbreakable. The lessons of the War Brides are not confined to history books. They are playing out in every dating app, in every divorce court, in every relationship where a man believes his past deeds are enough to guarantee future loyalty. We have seen the setup, the perfect storm. We have seen the cold, hard data of mass female migration. We have felt the visceral, gut-wrenching pain of the individual soldiers betrayed by the very paradigm they were dying to protect. But this is only the beginning. This is only the broad outline of the phenomenon, because to truly grasp the depth of this, we must journey to the epicenter of the crisis itself. We must go to the conquered nations, to the ruined cities of Germany and Japan, for it is here, in the absolute ashes of defeat, where all social order had collapsed, where survival was a day-to-day struggle, that female hypergamy displayed its most ruthless, most shocking, and most strategically brilliant form. The story of the War Bride is not just about British women choosing American GIs over British Tommies. It is about what happened when the fighting stopped, the smoke cleared, and the victors stood amidst the rubble, and the women of the defeated nations looked upon them not with hatred, but with opportunity. In the next chapter, we cross a line that few historians have dared to tread. We will explore the darkest, most forbidden aspect of this entire phenomenon. What did hypergamy look like when the alternative was starvation? What happens when the enemy soldier, the man who bombed your city and killed your brothers, becomes the most valuable provider on the planet? We will uncover the stories of the German Fraulein's and the Japanese Pan-Pan girls who forged relationships with their former conquerors, not out of love, but out of a calculated, brutal necessity for survival. We will examine the children born of these unions and the societal scars they left behind. This is where the philosophical black pill becomes inescapable. This is where we learn that in the true calculus of survival, there is no room for hatred, only strategy. The journey into the heart of darkness continues. The silence that fell over Europe and the Pacific in 1945 was not the silence of peace. It was the silence of the grave, of exhaustion, of utter ruin. For the victors, it was a time of weary triumph, of slow demobilization and the long voyage home. But for the vanquished, it was the beginning of a new and in many ways more terrifying struggle. The struggle for survival in a world that had been systematically dismantled. Cities were reduced to jagged silhouettes against the sky. Landscapes of rubble where the stench of death and decay lingered for years. There was no food. There was no fuel. There was no law. The social contract, that fragile agreement that holds civilization together, had been torn to shreds. In this absolute zero of human existence, where every pretense of morality and culture had been stripped away, only the most primal instincts remained. And it is here, in the absolute heart of darkness, that we witness the ultimate, most ruthless, and most philosophically devastating expression of female hypergamy. This is not the story of choosing a handsome American pilot over a local boy. This is the story of what happens when the choice is between aligning with the man who burned your city to the ground or watching your child starve to death in your arms. To understand the landscape, one must first comprehend the totality of the defeat. In Germany, the concept of Stunde Null, zero hour, was born. It was the acknowledgement that the clock had been reset, that everything before was irrelevant, and that life would now be measured in calories, cigarettes, and chunks of coal. The occupying forces, American, British, French, and Soviet, were not merely soldiers. They were gods. They controlled everything. They possessed the only viable currency: food, medicine, chocolate, nylon stockings, and the overwhelming power of life and death. A single American GI feeding a can of sea rations to a German child was a more potent symbol of power than any tank. In Japan, the devastation was even more complete. The atomic bombs had vaporized two cities, but the conventional firebombing had incinerated dozens more. The divine emperor, a living god for centuries, had been forced to renounce his divinity. The Japanese people were not just defeated, they were spiritually annihilated, adrift in a cosmos that had fundamentally and violently broken. Into this psychic and physical vacuum stepped the American occupier, the Gaijin, the barbarian, who now held the keys to existence itself.
It is within this context that the most shocking and strategically brilliant hypergamous maneuvers took place. The women of the defeated nations, particularly Germany and Japan, faced a calculation so brutal it makes the Dear John letters seem sentimental. Their men were gone, dead, crippled, or languishing in POW camps, returning broken and emasculated, often unable to even speak of their trauma. Their status reduced to less than zero by the sheer fact of their defeat. To be a German man in 1945 was to be a pariah, a symbol of failure and monstrous ideology. To be a Japanese man was to be the embodiment of a failed divine mandate. They could not provide. They could not protect. They offered only a shared starvation and a legacy of shame. And then there were the victors. The Americans. They were healthy, well-fed, confident, and possessed of a seemingly bottomless abundance. They represented the ultimate evolutionary prize, survival itself. Aligning with them was not a matter of social climbing, it was a matter of biological imperative. This was hypergamy stripped of all romance, all pretense, all artifice. It was a raw Darwinian transaction. The term for these relationships has been sanitized by history, fraternization. But this clinical word hides a universe of desperation, calculation, and survival. The Allied command initially strictly forbade fraternization with the German populace. It was seen as a security risk and a moral failing. But the order was utterly unenforceable. It was like forbidding the tide to come in. The attraction was not merely romantic, it was gravitational. The American GI, often lonely and far from home, sought companionship. The German Fräulein sought salvation. A famous, haunting photograph from the time captures this dynamic perfectly. A beautiful young German woman, her hair perfectly coiffed, walking through the rubble of her city. She is smiling, laughing, arm in arm with a handsome American soldier. In the background, a group of sullen, hollow-eyed German men watch them pass. The look on their faces is not one of anger, but of profound, existential defeat. They have lost the war, they have lost their city, and now they are watching the women of their nation, their lost connection to a future, choose the enemy. The woman is not a traitor, she is a pragmatist. She has made the only rational choice available to her in an irrational world. Her smile is not one of joy, but of relief. She has secured a patron in the new world order. The phenomenon in Japan was even more complex and culturally earth-shattering. The Panpan girls became a ubiquitous and tragic feature of the occupation. These were young Japanese women, often from good families, who had been utterly impoverished by the war, who solicited American GIs for money, food, or simple protection. The term itself is believed to be onomatopoeic, the sound of a hand slapping against another in a transaction. But to reduce this to simple prostitution is to miss the profound hypergamous strategy at play. For many of these women, the goal was not a single meal or a pair of stockings. The goal was a permanent pairing. The goal was to become a war bride. They were engaging in the most high-stakes audition of their lives, using the only currency they had left to attract the attention of a high-status provider. The most successful of them did not see themselves as prostitutes. They saw themselves as strategists, navigating the ruins of their old world to secure a place in the new one. They learned English. They adopted American mannerisms. They offered not just sex, but the illusion of domesticity and companionship in a foreign and hostile land. For a lonely GI, this was a powerful lure. The relationship between a Pan-Pan girl and her GI was a microcosm of the entire occupation, a transaction of power, where resources and security were exchanged for companionship and a semblance of normalcy. The children born from these unions, the so-called occupation babies, are the living testament to this brutal period. In Germany, they were called Mischlingskinder, or more cruelly, Besatzungskinder, occupation children. Their lives were often incredibly difficult, caught between two worlds, belonging to neither. They were living, breathing reminders of national humiliation and personal trauma. But their very existence is proof of the strategy's success. Their mothers, by securing a genetic link to the victor, ensured that their offspring would carry the passport of the winning tribe. This is hypergamy operating at its most fundamental, genetic level. It is not about emotion. It is about the cold, hard calculus of genetic legacy and resource acquisition. The mother may have faced ostracism, but her child might have a chance at a life in America, the land of plenty, far from the hungry ghosts of Europe. This was a long-term investment in the face of absolute short-term catastrophe. The case of Japan offers one of the most stunning examples of this calculated choice. The story of Hiroko, a young woman from a formerly aristocratic Tokyo family, is archetypal. Her family's home and wealth were vaporized in the firebombings. Her father, a proud imperial officer, committed seppuku upon hearing the emperor's surrender speech, unable to live in a world where his entire belief system had collapsed. Hiroko, her mother, and her younger sister were left destitute, living in a shack and scrounging for food. The arrival of the Americans was initially met with terror, but terror soon gave way to a chilling pragmatism. Hiroko watched as other women in her neighborhood began to associate with GIs. They came back with food, medicine, and most importantly, a sense of security. One day, a young American officer, lost, asked her for directions. She spoke a little English. He was polite, handsome, and clearly powerful. She made a choice in that moment that would have been unthinkable 2 years prior. She did not see the enemy. She saw a provider. She cultivated the relationship with the strategic precision of a general. She learned to make apple pie from care package ingredients. She listened to his stories. She offered him a refuge from the stress of occupation duty. Within a year, she was married to him and on her way to a new life in California. She left her past, her culture, and her mother and sister behind. Was this a betrayal, or was it the ultimate act of familial loyalty, removing herself as a mouth to feed and potentially creating a lifeline for her family later? This is the impossible moral calculus of crisis hypergamy. There is no right answer. There is only survival and the relentless drive to secure the best possible outcome for oneself and one's genetic line. This behavior is not a historical aberration. It is the default setting of human nature when the veneer of civilization is scraped away. The lessons for the modern man are not about blaming women for being pragmatic. The lesson is about understanding the true nature of the game. The Black Pill philosophy is, at its core, a radical acceptance of reality devoid of sentimentality. The war bride phenomenon is the ultimate Black Pill. It demonstrates, with horrific clarity, that a man's value is contingent and contextual. The same German soldier who was a hero in 1941 was a pariah in 1945. His inherent qualities had not changed. His courage, his loyalty, his love for his country, but his status had been utterly inverted. The American GI's inherent qualities were largely irrelevant. His status as a victor and a provider was everything. For the modern man, this translates to a simple, unforgiving truth. Your past deeds are irrelevant.
Your promises are meaningless. Your inherent goodness is worthless. Your value is determined by your present ability to provide, protect, and project power and security in the here and now. The man who loses his job and falls into depression cannot appeal to the love he once shared with his partner. He is, in that moment, a defeated soldier returning to a homeland that has moved on. The man who fails to maintain his physical health, his mental fortitude, and his mission in life is a man inviting a silent, slow-motion Dear John letter. The world may not be in literal rubble around us, but the social and economic landscape is perpetually unstable. Crisis is always looming. A market crash, a personal illness, a social upheaval. In those moments, the same primal instincts that guided the war bride will surface. They are always there, simmering beneath the surface, waiting for the pressure to drop enough for them to burst forth. The inspiring, albeit dark, conclusion from this entire saga is not one of despair, but of empowerment through clarity. The man who understands these forces is no longer a slave to a fairy tale. He is a strategist. He knows that his work is never done. His mission is eternal. He must forever be building, maintaining, and increasing his status, his resources, and his strength. He does this not for a woman, but for himself. His value is his own creation, his own fortress. A woman may share in that fortress, but she is not the reason for its construction. The war brides, from the English girls to the German Fräuleins to the Japanese Pan-Pan girls, were not evil. They were rational actors in an irrational situation. They were playing the oldest game on earth with a ruthless efficiency that commands a certain grim respect. They teach us that in the theater of human relations, there is no room for audience members. There are only actors and those who are acted upon. The choice for a man is simple. Build an unassailable fortress of your own value, become the victor in your own life, and understand the dark, primal currents that guide human choice. Or risk becoming the man standing in the rubble, watching silently as the world moves on without you, a ghost of a forgotten war, wondering what he did wrong. The war is over, but the lessons are eternal.